This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This is iFanboy Booksplode, Classic G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, Volume 1.
We'll fight for freedom wherever there's trouble. G.I. Joe is there.
G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero. G.I. Joe is there.
It's G.I. Joe against Cobra and Destro, fighting to save the day. He never gives up, he's always there, fighting for freedom over land and air.
G.I. Joe.
Hello, welcome to iFanboy Booksplode, Classic G.I. Joe, Real American Hero, Volume 1. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and I am here with Flanagan, Josh A.
Codename. I had nothing. I really wanted a good one, and I was like, whatever I say is going to be disappointing. So, yeah, I'm still a trainee. I'm working on it. Sergeant Slaughter is, you know, he's going to give me, and at the end we'll come out of it, and he's like, that's Fumbles, the new recruit.
Rank E1. Fumbles.
Chatterbox.
So we're here to discuss this G.I. Joe volume. We'll get to the specifics in a second, but this is the Booksplode that was unlocked by the patrons at patreon.com/ifanboy. Thank you for being a patron if you are one. If you're not, please consider it. It's how all these shows stay going, and it's a going concern, and we appreciate everyone who supports the show. So spoilers for this nearly 40-year-old comic, or is it 40 years old?
41.
Oh, Jesus. 41-year-old comic. So
40, 42.
If you're listening to the Pick of the Week show regularly right now, you know that Josh and I are on a G.I. Joe kick after being in G.I. Joe slumber for many years. Josh had been reading the issues, single issues, and we decided let's do a Booksplode. There isn't actually a current printing of this book. What we're talking about is the Classic G.I. Joe Real American Hero Volume 1, which is what IDW put out when they initially got the license many, many years ago. They put out at least 12 volumes of really nice quality, high quality collections of 10 issues apiece. And so we're talking about the first 10 issues of G.I. Joe that are in this first volume. And perhaps a few more after that, depending on how things go. But if you're looking for this volume, it's really not something that's currently in print. You have to find it in a secondary market, and they're quite expensive. I'd be very curious to see if now that they're with Image, if Image will go back and do it. My gut is they won't. They'll do the new issues as collected editions, but not the old ones. That's my guess.
It's been done before.
Marvel originally started putting out collections. They didn't make it through the whole run. I have those. I think they've made about 5 or 6 of them. And then when IDW did it, they put the whole initial Larry Hammer run in collected form. They did the whole thing.
Did you buy them again? Did you buy the ones from IDW that you already had from Marvel?
Oh, yeah, for sure. This is what I'm holding in my hand is the IDW Volume 1 here.
Right.
I have the first 10. I stopped at 10, which takes you through issue 100 for some reason, even though I stopped reading around 110 or 120. I don't know why I stopped short of where I should have. I should have at least gotten Volume 11, which ends with the massacre for the Viper, but... Mm-hmm. Didn't do that for whatever reason. Now that book is like $100 if you can find it at all. So, G.I. Joe, originally published by Marvel Comics, G.I. Joe number one came out March 82.
Cover date, famously June of 82, or famously among people who know things like this. And yeah, but it came out in March of 82.
We were five. Well, I was four.
I did not buy the first issue. I had just turned five, actually. So.
Right. You weren't out there on the newsstand looking for G.I. Joe?
No, I didn't. I was not. Y'all got any of that, Joe? No. I mentioned to you earlier off air. I went through the Toys That Made Us G.I. Joe episode today.
Yeah.
Just to sort of have a little more context on it.
It's on Netflix, in case you're wondering. It's a great resource.
I've avoided all of them altogether because of the simple fact that they have recreations, and I cannot abide dramatizations of real scenes in a documentary. It drives me insane.
Wait, had you not watched it before?
No, I hadn't. No.
Oh, this is exciting.
No. I was like, oh, this is one of those documentaries that has a recreation. I hate it. But that said, you know, like, I can get past my biases. It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But what I thought was really interesting is that, so G.I. Joe was in the 60s and 70s, extremely popular toys. They were the first boy dolls, and that's why they were called action figures. At the time, they were losing ground to Star Wars. And so we got to do something. And they said, we'll come out with
our
own.
They were big toys. They were like 18-inch figures. Little known fun fact, our old pal Darwin Cook had a massive collection of those original G.I. Joe figures. Like a massive collection that he, and I have not seen this with my own eyes, I've only seen photographs, set up an incredible diorama in his house.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Anyway, just to get the context of why the comic exists, and it is that they were trying to break a rule. Basically, you're only allowed to show animation for a certain amount of time in a kid's cartoon. And they said, well, what if we're advertising a comic book? And so by advertising the toys, they were advertising the comic book. So as they tried to come up with this scenario to put these characters, they started a comic book. And so it was developed with Marvel Comics at the same time as the toy line was being developed. In fact, and I will not do this because it's dumb. Like, we saw it, but I'll read all the things. But in fact, at some point, somebody, I think at Marvel, said, so who are they supposed to fight? And the Hasbro people were like, just your other toys? And Marvel was like, well, we got to give him somebody. And it was, and they said it like he was nobody. They were like, and then Marvel editor Archie Goodwin, I was like, the Archie Goodwin? You know, but that's maybe from my perspective. The story goes that he just blurted out, Cobra? And thus it was born. And so they added
I think people understand that that's how a lot of comic book stuff happens.
Oh, sure.
Somebody goes, what about if we kill him? And that's how Superman gets killed.
It just goes, what do you want to call him? Cobra? Like, because they couldn't use the Soviet Union. And this is all context of the Cold War, blah, blah, blah. And so they added those three other characters, Cobra Commander, Cobra Soldier, and Cobra Officer, whatever specifically they're called is a little different. And that's how you end up with bad guys, which is a good move, by the way, is having bad guys. And so they develop all this stuff, and they do, I think, a year's worth of comics or something like that. And then they all hold because Empire Strikes Back had come out. And so then when they're ready to go, they have this backlog of stories and characters that were largely written and created by Larry Hama. He was the one who wrote the little dossiers that are on the back of the toys that tell you who everybody is and sort of infuse life into all those things. And I mean, I don't know about you, Connor. We never talked about it, but like, I lived by those little dossiers. I loved it.
Oh,
like,
sure.
Having a story that went with those toys was great.
I cut them all out. I had a little file of them.
The cartoon comes along after that. More people knew about that. Not long after that.
83.
But this other stuff existed beforehand. And it's important to note, again, for nerds like us, that this is not related to the cartoons. It is a different continuity, if you will. The cartoon took a lot of this characterization, but not all of it. And finally, Larry Hama said, all these people are running around with guns and stuff. And in the cartoon, you can't have anybody shoot anybody or anybody get hurt. And what he said was that is, quote, morally bankrupt. And I believe that as this series progresses, you see how he exercised his belief about violence and shooting and killing as opposed to the cartoon. And I will close with just saying, I did not read these when I was young. I read them when I was older, like in my early 20s, because a friend of mine said, have you ever read those? And I was like, no. And he goes, they're amazing. And I read them and they were amazing. But it's been a really long time since I did that. So going back through here, it was pretty much like new, not completely.
Yeah.
And you're looking at it with 20 years later sensibility.
And it does take a while to get to amazing.
Yeah.
I was trying to think, and there's just no way to know, but I definitely remember being in my elementary school cafeteria passing around G.I. Joe issues with my friends. I definitely remember playing with G.I. Joe figures in our classrooms. You know, like when we played blocks, we made little forts from the G.I. Joe guys. I remember the one kid who somehow managed to find a Storm Shadow and brought him in. And we all were like a bunch of 6 or 7 year old boys going, ooh, around the storm, you know, because they were hard to find back then. So I don't know. If I had to hazard a guess, I would say I came on in the 30s, maybe, and then went back issue hunting. I remember the distinct difficulty in finding the Snake Eyes origin issues, 26 and 27, and even 28 a little bit. I wasn't a regular reader and probably until after that, but the G.I. Joe was always around. Once I started reading, I was a regular reader up until, like I said, around 110 or 120, and then I dropped off. And then when it moved to IDW, I started up again. We all did. I remember G.I. Joe number one was the pick of the week after 9/11. We lasted a while there, but not a long, long time. If I had to hazard a guess, I would say, you know, right now we're on issue 303. There's at least 100 issues of G.I. Joe I've never read in that Larry Hama continuity. Mm-hmm. I'd have to guess. No, you're right. This is a totally different thing than cartoons. The cartoons is almost like the kiddie version of the comic, which, again, was all designed to sell toys. I'm looking at the IDW collection, which has J. Scott Campbell covers. And the collection, the first issue, is a recreation of the first issue of the comic, which is a tank in the background and all the characters running at you. Only the collection has added Snake Eyes because he wasn't on the first issue cover. Right. It's replaced Hawk with Duke, who's not at all in the first collection.
No, and we had that discussion, perhaps on the show, perhaps not. Where you're like, yes, I swear he was in it, and that was Hawk, who
looks and sounds and acts like Duke.
Yeah, he's he gets promoted at some point, and then Duke shows up, and I think that it's Hawk
and General Flag, and then Hawk becomes General Hawk, and Duke takes over Hawk's role. But I haven't even gotten to that point yet.
Doesn't Flag become Admiral, and then he gets the? No, wait, that is the Flag.
Yes. So anyway, this was fun for me because it's been a long time since I've read them, gone back and read through these early issues. And what I found most interesting, just to dive in, is to see how they're figuring it out on the page. Because, you know, knowing the continuity so well, knowing the characters so well, seeing the things that don't match up or line up because they're figuring it out. And as Josh and I, you and I discussed, the mythology, the ongoing story of G.I. Joe doesn't really start until issue 10, the final issue of this collection, Welcome to Springfield. Springfield being, of course, the Cobra Town. Oh, actually, it's called A Nice Little Town Like Ours. Welcome to Springfield's on the cover.
Right.
But issue 9 and 8 are, is it 9 and 8 or two-parters? There's a two-part Russian story, but the rest are all...
6 and 7 is the Arctic team-up with the October Guard.
Yes, that's the only two-parter. The rest are all one-and-done stories.
Yes, with slight continuity, but not a ton. There is character continuity for sure.
Right. But you don't... It isn't until like 11 or 12... Other than that one October Guard story where it's like the next issue starts where the last issue ended, like that becomes the soap opera quality. It doesn't start until around that point.
Yeah, there's a point where like Larry Hama does his thing. And he actually said this in the doc is that he said, sure, I can do this because he, you know, he was just a guy around. There was a lower tier editor around the office and he did it. And then he's like, what the hell else am I going to do with this? And so, you know, after he sort of did that first chunk of them, and it should be noted, he scripted 7 of the first 10. He wrote fully. The two-parter was a plot by Herb Trimp, who had drawn the issues prior to that, and then Hama scripted it. And then issue 9 was written by Stephen Grant,
right,
who I mostly knew from his Comic Book Resources column. And then I think Hama owns it from there on out.
Right. You can tell that it was kind of the Marvel method, right, where
yes,
Trimp would draw it, and then Larry Hama would come and script it. We haven't really talked about this, though. Larry Hama, who was most closely associated with G.I. Joe, he was a Vietnam vet. He was there from 69 to 71. He was a firearms and explosive ordnance expert. And in the 80s, for people who are younger than us, maybe not understand how much all the people that were older than us at the time were working through their Vietnam issues, whether they were in the war or not.
And we didn't know it at the time either. It was like later when Connor and I look back and go, oh, all of this.
Yeah, all the movies, all the TV shows.
Everything
was people who had been in the war or had been protesting the war or had lost someone in the war. Processing that. And so you had things like Marvel Comics producing a book called The Nam, a realistic comic book about Vietnam. And you had this other book called G.I. Joe, which was not set in that time period, but was clearly a way of dealing with it. And then certainly as you get later on, you start dealing with the flashbacks to Vietnam because the character served in it.
Yeah.
And so as a kid, that was heavy. I still remember those panels from, and then didn't Larry Hama draw those issues? You had all this stuff. Larry Hama becomes the figurehead, the guy who runs, you know, the whole thing. He brought a sense of, this is going to sound crazy talking about G.I. Joe, but reality to it. And look, everything in here is designed to sell toys, vehicles, etc. But the way they talked about the weapons, the way they classified them, the acronyms they used to talk about things, all that stuff comes from this guy who Josh said earlier was trying to bring some moral clarity to what was happening.
I think that right there is part of the magic of it, if you will. It is clearly I mean, it was intended to sell toys. And in like the first chunk of issues of the first year, 10 or whatever, there was no ambiguity about the fact that these are vehicles with which to sell toys. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, come on and I'll make something of it. It isn't that. It's that it is the thing. It is a commercial exploitation of Cold War fears and boys' love of war.
Right.
It is. And then at the same time, you have this writer who somehow managed to weave in his specific experiences and then those of, you know, people around him and the things that he'd experienced in a way that incongruously, impossibly kind of works. And I can't help but think, as you and I, you know, men careening towards the age of 50, are still talking about this and thinking mm-hmm. about it this much longer. And I can't help but believe that that touch of realism, that little bit of like, wow, the technical language here sounds awful real, that didn't attract and hold a lot of us. If I can't speak for everybody, but, you know, you and I are interested in history. We're interested in the things that happen. We read books about it. We talk about it. And this had a smattering of that at an age where we were too young to appreciate it, but it was there. And I think that that's very interesting in retrospect.
I often have said many times over the years at Fanboy and have been sometimes scoffed at by people younger than us that this is one of the most important comics ever made. And that's because in the 80s, and not Josh, but everyone I knew who was reading comics read G.I. Joe and watched G.I. Joe and was brought to comics from that, or somehow G.I. Joe was the on-ramp to going to the store every week because, you know, you played the toys, you watched the cartoon. Oh, there's a comic book. I'll read that too. Oh, there's other comic books. I'll read Spider-Man. And suddenly you had someone going every week to the store. That was a very common on-ramp in my friend groups in the 1980s. Literally everyone I was friends with read comics back then.
That's what I didn't have. I didn't have that.
All the people at school, people in my neighborhood, people I played baseball with or soccer. Every one of my friend group read comics in some way. Most of them went every week, but some just, you know, read old issues. But everyone read them or had them. It was a common thing. Comics, Mad Magazine, and Cracked Magazine. But G.I. Joe was one of the most popular things in that time. And that's why it's one of the most important comics, because not only was it, in a way, really subversive. I don't know how he was able to get away with some of the stuff he did in his books, especially later on. But it was very important to growing the fan base, you know, growing the next generation of comic readers. And it's a really, really important book. Now, you know, these first 10 issues aren't that comic, but we're getting there. That's what's interesting about
it. No. Well, that's also interesting, though, that nascent thing about a person who has actually turned into an auteur comic book writer to this day. We read a new issue last week, you know, was able to turn that into like his life's work. And I kept thinking, I was like, God, I hope he had some kind of back end on something.
At least it's a regular paycheck.
I mean,
he's had a regular paycheck since 81.
And in comics, that's not nothing. That was Jack Kirby's dream, regular paycheck.
But again, getting back to this collection, so G.I. Joe is the highly trained special mission force. They're basically like this clandestine special forces unit within the military, and their main objective is to fight Cobra, who are a ruthless terrorist organization determined to rule the world, who run by this lunatic madman, Cobra Commander, who is one of my favorite characters in all of fiction.
Agree.
So like I said, what's fun for me reading this, first of all, just reading the stories, was to see how they were figuring it out. Like in the beginning, the characters are speaking really clunky dialogue when they would talk about their equipment. And I'm trying to find the one, but it's going to be impossible. But they would be like, that's the MOBAT, the mobile on, you know, they would spell out the whole acronym in the dialogue balloon. It was only towards the very end when he started replacing that with the editor's notes, which became famous in G.I. Joe for spelling out all the acronyms. So at first it was all in the dialogue, and then you watch them figure out, no, let's just put that in the editor's note. And then you'd see things like, you know, they hadn't figured out what exactly Snake Eyes was all about or who his friends were. And so at one point, early on, Snake Eyes does something and Stalker's like, oh, why is he doing that? And someone else said, whoa, he's doing that because of this. I said, no, you should switch those dialogue balloons because Stalker would be the one who would know that, being his lifelong friend.
Right.
But they didn't know back then. They were figuring it out. And almost every time Snake Eyes' mask comes off, he either has hair, he doesn't have hair. It was always kind of different. Again, they were making it up as they went along.
I didn't remember the detail from it in any way, except for the fact that I knew that every time his mask come off, somebody went, ugh! You know, like someone was disgusted by his face under there, which I liked. And I did learn a thing today that I did not know. I'm going to not bring this up anymore, but it was so relevant, is that there was a point where the people making the toys were told they were going to have to raise the price, but they didn't want to. So what they did was they said, well, we'll do one of the characters unpainted. And so Snake Eyes came out completely black, plastic, no painting. And they thought, well, we'll see if people buy that, but we save some money. And of course, it becomes the most popular character out in the line by far.
People always have just a nefarious plot behind everything that happens. Sometimes it's just happenstance.
Yeah.
But there was a sense also pretty quickly that Snake Eyes is the coolest guy here, even though I think in a way, in these first 10 issues, Scarlet's the main character.
Okay, there's a couple of things we need to talk about.
Yeah.
I don't know the best format for this, but Scarlet's very much the main character. And I thought, as I was reading it, and I've noticed this in the cartoon too, despite Clutch's best effort at objectifying her, she is just a capable soldier in these books.
Yes.
Like, she happens to be a woman, but that's it. There is a startling lack of sexual or gendered stereotyping about her or the way that people treat her, again, except for Clutch, who is a problem.
You know what? You sent me the panels before I started reading it, and totally is, for about the first half of this book. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't know if they got a note or what, but it gets toned way down. And then, by the end, he's not even making those comments anymore.
Yeah, he's like the smart ass, but I know what you mean, but I guess
in the beginning, it's all like every time she shows up, he's like, you know, he's, right. His eyes pop out of his head, his tongue rolls down. But then by the end, I mean, there's that one mission they go on to Europe where she's in a bikini. Yeah. He doesn't say a word about it.
Yeah, you're right. They just toned it down.
They definitely toned it down. They must have gotten a note.
Maybe. I mean, yeah, I'm not disagreeing with that. But either way, the sort of respect that they had for that character, like I said, I'm noticing in the cartoons too, it's really surprising. She was first wave and, you know, she's kind of the most capable. Snake Eyes is capable in a different way. They didn't figure out that Snake Eyes was cool until about the end of this sort of chunk of issues. Like, he was just another guy.
Well, he was the ninja, but they didn't really think about the possibilities of that. And also, similar to Scarlet, Stalker, the one at the beginning, the one black character, is sort of the highest ranking soldier after Hawk.
Yeah. You have an Asian American who's writing all this.
Yeah.
And in the aftermath of, you know, in 82, we had not figured out racial identity in politics nearly to the extent that we have now. You know, but you have a guy who fought in Vietnam. I mean, there's a whole lot going on there. And in a way, you know, it's really hard to speculate about all of it, but like G.I. Joe is really diverse for the time. Oh, it's
totally way ahead of its time in terms of every race being represented, every culture. There's American Indian characters, there's Latino characters, there's black characters. In the 80s, that was totally, totally unusual.
There are stereotypes in there.
Sure.
But you almost can't help that, but I still feel like they were doing their damn best to be respectful in the way that they could at the time. Spirit Iron Knife talks a little like a cartoon Indian, and I say that, you know, actually, is it in this one? I think it's...
No, he's not in the first volume at all.
No, but Airborne is.
Airborne is,
I think, Franklin Talltrees.
Yes.
And someone says to him, "You're an Indian." He goes, "I am a Native American." And I was like, damn, getting ahead of it. That really stood out.
I actually think that was the very beginning of volume two, but
okay,
I did catch on that because that was not a dialogue that I never saw in the 80s. Happen right. Anywhere. And so I was like, whoa, shit, wow, really? No, very progressive in that sense. That's why several years ago, there was a G.I. Joe miniseries that I stopped reading because they started racial swapping the characters. I was like, you don't need to racial swap characters in G.I. Joe. They're all there. If you want to have a black character in the story, pick one of the many black characters in the team.
Yeah.
It was ahead of its time in terms of diversity, but obviously not a panacea or a utopia, but it was ahead of its time in terms of what was fairly progressive in 1980.
They were trying. And I can't help but think with some of us, it made a dent.
Sure. So are there any stories in this first volume that stick out at you or anything that stuck out at you while reading it? The Herb Trimp art, I like it a lot. It's very much of its time.
Yeah.
But I think it's very well done. Oh, you know what we should talk about?
What?
You mentioned this. Every issue is dense as fuck.
Yes.
It's a very different way of writing comics. You said to me, you're not going to be able to read more than one or two at a time. And it's totally true. It's like exhausting in a good way.
They feel like double-sized issues.
Yes.
And they're not. And it's not... I don't know. I've said this before, but like, I didn't used to be able to read through a lot of old comics because there was so much junk in there that sometimes it didn't feel like it flowed very well. And now I've got I feel like I finally learned the ability to sort of appreciate things for what they are and enjoy the things about them that are inherent to the form. And so in this, I was just enjoying them, you know, for what they are and not being like, oh, this is so, I'm not comparing it to a modern comic. It is what it is from the time. And there's something interesting about that.
Part of the reason why I like watching old films is you can see them figuring the medium out, especially in the 20s and 30s. So here, same way, like obviously they weren't figuring out comics, but they were figuring out G.I. Joe and how to tell those stories. And I really enjoyed watching the progression. Like I said, so I'm looking at page 178 in the trade, whatever that is. And so now in the editor's note is Mobat and Vamp, you know, vehicle colon attack multipurpose for Vamp.
They really like had to stretch to get some of those words. Everything was given an acronym.
Yeah, in the earlier issues, it would have said, hey, I'm driving the vamp, the vehicle attack multipurpose. Mm-hmm. Then they realize they can make it better if they don't have him say it.
I didn't notice. That's a good observation. I like that. I think one of the things as we go through the story is there is, I know they're for kids' toys, but they're much more, you wouldn't see a kid's comic, like if something was dedicated like for eight-year-olds, you wouldn't see politics to this extent. So the first issue, we meet the Joes and Cobra, and the deal is the Cobra Commander has kidnapped a doctor. Scientist. There's always a doctor, professor, or scientist, or somebody like that. Cartoons too. Cobra Commander is obsessed with finding smart people to get them to do things for him.
Right.
And she has been outspoken about the United States and the military.
She's anti-military, anti-war.
Right. And so the Joes have to go get her. And of course, because they're soldiers, they're like, well, how are we going to get this peacenik? I don't know if they use that term, but, you know, and then, you know, they get there and Cobra Commander's like, see what they think of you. And he's like, yeah, but you're terrorists. I'm going with them. I'm paraphrasing everything.
Yeah.
But still, I was like, this is pretty high level for, again, kids' toys. I don't know. I feel like they have more respect for kids.
Oh, totally. They weren't being written down to. In the first issue, the Cobra salute is very much a Nazi salute.
Yes, it is.
And then at one point, oh, right. So in the first issue, on Cobra Island, there's also a native village. And to distract the Joes, they go and they massacre the village.
Jesus.
I was just like, Jesus. You know, look, I'm looking at page 25 on the trade, and it's, I don't believe it. Cobra wiped out the entire village. Women, kids, everybody. They did it to keep them from helping us. It's our fault. And I was like, damn, that's dark. That's the first issue of a book meant to sell toys.
Mm-hmm. We were damaged folk back then.
We were, yeah.
Then we head into that next issue is they're in the Arctic and we meet Quinn, the Eskimo. That's what they called him then and wouldn't call him that now. But Quinn is then becomes a recurring character and he's amazing because when he makes a deal, he sticks to the deal. He never lies. He never goes back on his bargain. And he's a wild card. You don't know what to expect from him. He shows up later. I love Quinn. I'm a big fan of Quinn.
He's like a moral absolutist. Like what he believes is right. He follows that to the letter. He'll be very pedantic about the letter of the law. Like in the second collection, which I'm reading now, he shows up and ends up helping G.I. Joe because his contract ends at Cobra when a certain thing happens.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I'm going to point out like how dark in the end of this second issue, they'd had this adventure in the Arctic with Quinn and Cobra, and Quinn helped these Cobra guys get away. But he basically tells the Cobra guys, G.I. Joe's going to get you. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, we're miles from them. He goes, yeah, they're trackers and you're not. And it's a slow pan over three panels, a wide shot of Scarlet, Breaker, Stalker, and Snake Eyes wearing Quinn's necklace, to a medium shot, to a close-up of Snake Eyes and his Uzi and the necklace. And it was just like a dark ending. They're going to track him down and kill these guys. And there's a lot of just indiscriminate machine gunning of people in these comics.
Yes.
Again, in a way that would never happen now for various reasons, maybe good or maybe bad. I don't know.
Yeah, this is hard to say. Then we have a third issue is a robot. It's the Trojan. I forget what it's called. The Trojan something. Trojan Gambit.
I like that issue a lot.
It was really great. It was a locked box sort of adventure. We have to get there before the robot destroys everything.
The Joes bring their robot pieces back to their base, their hidden base in Staten Island, New York, which later on an issue is said to be in New Jersey, but then goes back to Staten Island. They were just making it up as they went. What they don't realize is Cobra has rigged the robot to reassemble itself and cause havoc in the base and then help Cobra find the base because it's a hidden base. And so they've got to destroy the robot before it can get its signal out. And that was just a terrific, as you said, lockbox issue.
And it was like really it came down to the very last second, you know, as the robot keeps getting blown up and it's smaller and smaller and smaller and these little sort of like spider robots end up and they get, you know, crushed at the end and that's sort of the end of it. And it really goes right up the last page and the threat is ended. Really nice. You know, nobody knows the threat they're under.
Yeah.
That was good.
I would love to know why the transition from Hawk to Duke when it's the same character with the same appearance. I'm curious why they
I'm not that there change. Yet. It has to have to do with the cartoon.
Or the toys.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't a Hawk toy. Not till later.
Hmm.
There wasn't a Hawk toy until he had the brown hair and he had the jacket with the, you know, the fur collar.
Maybe
there
it was
wasn't
a mistake.
Like an original Hawk toy.
Maybe it was a mistake. Maybe he was supposed to be Duke all along. And then,
maybe.
I don't know. And then the cartoon came out. Like he looks like that. We have to make him Duke. And then
the next issue features Snake Eyes' lovely penmanship.
Well, that
very
was
tight.
The right-wing survivalist group in the wilds of America. Again, kids love that. And then like we learn that he's willing to kill all of his acolytes, you know, and some of them finally turn against him again.
Hawk's undercover because he's a Aryan.
Yeah.
That was dark.
It was.
And then one of my favorites is the next one, is number 5, Tanks for the Memories.
Yeah.
With the, again, where's the dialogue? Here we go. Come on, Scarlet, you got to get the program. Pick up a sponge and help us scrub down the old Mobat multi-ordnance battle tank. That's something that would later go into an editor's note.
This is the one that has incredibly phallic shots of them sitting on the tank. Very much so.
Breaker, who always is blowing a bubble. Steeler, Clutch, and Scarlet are on... Well, Scarlet's not in the tank parade, but they're on the military parade through the streets of New York. That's definitely a thing that happens. Then, of course, Cobra attacks, and they have to sort of fight Cobra off without the brass knowing it. And so it's sort of this clandestine rolling tank battle through the streets of New York City, which they have to keep secret.
They can't use it as a tank?
Because they've got no ordnance. They have to pretend they've got... It was very clever, and I like this issue a lot.
I remember the toy like kind of just looked like a regular tank, but this one they're like, no, here's what's great about the tank, and it's like it goes underwater and it's got all this other stuff. It looks like a normal tank, but it's better than that. You know, as this sort of crowd of stuffy generals and or the maybe they're the Joint Chiefs.
One guy really wanted to see the tanks. I was told specifically that we would be reviewing his display of spanking new armor.
Mm-hmm.
He really wanted to see tanks.
I can't tell who the characters are just by looking at them. Because in the first wave, they all looked, but one of them is really into looking at the majorette's butt, which is...
I think that's Clutch.
Is it Clutch? Yeah, I figured.
Or Steeler.
Let's say I'm fulfilling the obligation of a military commander to keep abreast of the rear guard situation. Okay, you got a pun about boobs. And there's not like, he's looking through the screen at the woman in front of him. It turns out to be a Cobra. She's a shapely majorette. Let's not mince words here. But the screen that he's watching her on, her head is cut off. Like, he's looking at her ass.
Yes.
Kids
comic.
Very funny. Very good.
The jocks who are just going for a nice rowboat in Central Park. The 3 City High football players who just happen to be in a rowboat for some reason, who make fun of the turkeys in the marching band uniforms. Only nerds who join the stupid marching band, and then they get tossed overboard because the tank comes out of the water and knocks their boat over. But why are they in the rowboat?
Well, one of those kids was named Winklevoss, and he would go on to have twin sons who would be involved.
I just thought this was combined sort of the absurdity and the fun of it, but also being clever and good character stuff. General Flag gets shot in the head by Cobra Commander, but only glancingly. I thought it was a good issue. I didn't love the October Guard two-parter. I liked it. I didn't love it as much as their other issues for some reason.
I liked it in the midst of the Cold War. There was that they basically... The Russians and the Americans had to work together, and it was under the guise of, so basically there's a secret plane or something that they have to go get, and the Soviets are also after it, and then they find out that Cobra's after it too. So Cobra steals it, and the Joes and the Russians have to work together, and with the understanding that the second that Cobra's defeated, they're going to go back to fighting. And in this story, they get to kind of like and respect each other while they are not at each other.
Because they get to meet each other.
And it's such a great... You know, again, this is in the midst of the Cold War. I cannot, if you were not alive, you cannot fathom how much we hated Soviet people for the prior 40 years. And it is culminating at this point in history. And there's this little comic book that is just going, you know, they're not that different. They would probably get along fine.
You also have a brief appearance from basically the Mujahideen.
Yes, yes. On our side, prior.
Who are at the time were on our side. Was this prior? This must have been prior to when we armed them. With the surface-to-air missiles.
Mm-hmm.
They're incredibly competent. They don't fuck around. The CIA guy's there helping the Joes set up. Mm-hmm. And he's... Stalker's just a two-bit infantryman. He can't help you. And the guy says, he's a fighting man. See, so I knew you wouldn't understand. Like, mm-hmm. they respected the Joes. The Joes respected them. And then, you know, you've got a map. They're going to Karachi. They're in Pakistan. They're going to all these places now that are just the hotbeds of anti-American terrorism sentiment. You know, they're in Kabul. They're in the Hindu Kush. They're going to escape to Pakistan to make their escape. It's a good snapshot of how different the world was back then.
Yeah. And, you know, if you know anything about history, then you see where that stuff leads and sort of where we started and where we ended up.
Well, they try to make us think that Hawk's a bad guy, but he's not.
You know what? I was saying that when that came up, I felt like I didn't get that resolved.
He fed them fake information as a fake mole to send them to the wrong. Because the whole thing was they were all fighting over a decoy that the rest of the Joes had already rescued the right plane, but...
But he told them that like a dick.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to tell you that you were all decoys. It was for no reason. He did. He told them when they landed.
Right.
In the beginning, he says it to Stalker's face. I was like, that's fucking cold, dog.
This is good stuff.
As we get into 8, the Joes are protecting a space launch in Florida as Cobra has a full-on attack on the coast of Florida.
Right.
And this is the all Herb Trimp. Larry Hama didn't write or have anything to do with this one. It's action-packed. I'll give it that.
I didn't hate it.
I don't remember a lot about it. I like there was a bit where it was like military tactics in terms of them, you know, like they formed a perimeter and that's, and you just see like, again, it's called Sea Strike. Actually, some great art in this one. The first couple of pages, there's a Cobra boat and Cobra Commander is, you know, standing in the wind and rain and his like cloak is floating over him. I found that as we went through this, the art got better. Like as they sort of settled into who everybody was at first, it was like, oh, this is just a day job or whatever. Mm-hmm. And as we kept going, the art gets stronger. Did Trimp draw this too? Yes. Script and art. I was surprised to see his name because I didn't remember it. And I didn't know who he was probably when I first read this. Because Mike Vosburgh, I don't know if he's on before the end of this. Is he?
Vosburgh's on the next issue that Stephen Grant writes.
So Vosburgh's first issue is bad looking. And then I thought, oh, I remember this as being better than this. But he gets, as you get into next sort of bunch of issues, like 9's really rough. There's parts where it's like, this is not professional. And what it is not that it's not professional. It's that he didn't give a shit. Like he was workaday. Right. He was like, here, this is good enough. It's for a kid.
He's doing a toy comic.
And Hama said something about that. He's doing the toy comic. That's nothing. That's bullshit. No one wants that. And then as they get going, because I remember, I was like, Vosburgh, that's a name he's on for a while. And very quickly, his stuff gets a lot better.
Even in this issue, there are really nice sequences or nice panels. I'm looking at the panel where Scarlet skis down a hill onto a jump, jumps into the air, and then crashes through the window to break up the arms deal. Like that panel where she's crashing through the window is terrific.
There's a bit where in this same issue where a plane, they have to take a plane down, it crashes in the Himalayas.
Yep.
You know, you want to talk about storytelling? The page where that happens, it's so good. So, you know, when I said art's not great, there's clearly figure problems here and here that don't matter. Oh, by the way, this issue number 9, Dutch Whorehouse.
Yes. This is the unnamed Dutch brothel in which some of the action takes place. Yes.
It's clearly like there's no like, well, this looks like it could be. They're in Amsterdam. These are clearly working ladies. There is a madam. They're all standing around smoking in skimpy undergarments.
But at 6 years old, I wouldn't have known that.
I know. But I did really want to go to Amsterdam. I didn't understand why.
There's some good trade craft. This is when they're in the south of France. They fight on land, sea, and air in this one.
Yeah, they're all over the world.
It feels almost like a James Bond movie. You know, they go to France and they go to Amsterdam and there's a room that's bugged. It's communicating by paper. Like there's a lot more interesting things happening, even if the art isn't up to snuff. This is Stephen Grant's doing. It feels almost much more international than you had before, even though before they were in Afghanistan and stuff. But it just felt like a fun, sexy Bond story.
And again, Scarlet is the hero of this. And I'm not even being the hero. She's the leader in this. Like, and Snake Eyes is along to help. When she, you know, she's not leading things. And then finally, as we sort of get near the end, issue number 10 introduces the town of Springfield.
10 is where it starts. 10 is where G.I. Joe starts to become G.I. Joe. This is where the story starts to kick off. A nice little town like ours, Larry Hammond, Mike Vosburgh, Chick Stone on inks. Chick's a good name.
You'll get a lot of chicks anymore.
One thing I do want to mention, and I'm looking at the cover to 10, there were some terrific classic covers on G.I. Joe. And I remember as a kid, again, if I started in the 30s looking at the early issues and the back issue bin and having only the covers to go by and look at cover 10, like Welcome to Springfield, nice little town, Scarlet Snake Eyes, you know, walking through this little suburban street, but the facade is fake. And like, it's like a movie set. Behind the movie set are a bunch of Cobra soldiers with AK-47s.
Except it is like, a real town.
As a kid, I wanted that issue so badly, you know, because what was that about? You know, they had really great covers. The cover of Stalker shooting back to back with the Russian guy is another one.
Every one of the covers was exactly what the story was.
Yeah.
It was dramatized. It was, you know, well conceived and they were good covers, but they were also directly narratively tied. And it wasn't even the kind where like it promises something that's sort of related to the story that wasn't. It was from the story or at least told you like the theme of the story.
Yeah.
Over and over. It really impressed me.
There's some really like all-time covers.
Yeah.
Issue 10 introduces the idea of Springfield, which is the town Cobra sort of takes over. First of all, it's important to note, in the Cobra side of things, in the early days, as Josh said earlier, they didn't have the characters. It's only really Cobra Commander and occasionally Baroness shows up, but the rest is just Cobra soldiers. They don't really introduce anybody else until the next volume. Then you get Destro, you get Major Blood. But in the beginning, it's really just Cobra Commander and sometimes Baroness. And so here she's back. And we find out that Cobra took over this town, you know, slowly. They started hiring people for ARBCO, the company that turns out to be Cobra, you know, front for Cobra. And very slowly, this becomes a company town where everyone's working for Cobra. Although not everybody's happy about it, but it's like this creepy, almost Twilight Zone-esque scenario, right? Where there's this small town in America that's being taken over by terrorists, but it's too late to stop it. It was good. It was really good.
It was, and it made me excited for sort of what comes next because, I mean, you look at more than 100 issues after this where he gets to sort of world build this. And I mean, I'm not going to tell you that you should come in here and be like, you should read this. Like people say you should read Watchmen.
Right.
But if you have any affinity for this stuff and you don't know about it, it's better than you think it could be. And it can just be entertaining also. I don't want to be like, mm-hmm. Oh man, it's much deeper than, you know, it doesn't be that. Yeah, exactly. If taken for what it is, taken in the the historical context of everything is extremely interesting.
And so this issue, we get the first inklings of a Snake Eyes origin. He gets put into Dr. Venom's contraption.
Dr. Venom, because we hadn't thought of Dr. Mindbender yet.
Right. He's basically Dr. Mindbender. What is the name of this machine?
I'm looking right at it. There's so many words here.
Yeah, whatever it is. It basically turns his memories into TV, you know, images. And they're trying to find the location of the pit at G.I. Joe base. But instead, Snake Eyes fights him off with other memories, leaving Saigon on the last helicopter, going to the prom, you know, working at the Texaco station. But again, them not knowing here, a helicopter crash in Vietnam is responsible for his disfigurement. That's kind of what happens in his official origin, but not really. Mm-hmm. His family being killed in a car accident, that's part of his origin. So like you start to get that, which you've never seen before. Snake Eyes, very strong chin in these issues. So you see his face in silhouette. You never see his face until much, much later in the series. And that's also something that was very popular back there in the 80s, was the characters whose faces you never saw. You never saw Cobra Commander's face. You never saw Snake Eyes' face. You never saw Destro's face. You never saw Dr. Doom's face back then.
As far as I'm concerned, we never saw Cobra Commander's face.
I mean, the most you ever saw was where he was wearing the round glasses, the fake mustache, the beret, and the wig. That was the unmasked issue on the cover where they're all taking their masks off. But you never actually see their faces, but you almost do.
The only thing of his face that I'm willing to admit is real is when he wears the hood and you see his skin around his eyes.
Right.
That's his face.
That was so exciting as a kid, you know, just getting a glimpse, a little glimpse of their face. And it wasn't like Destro was going to take off his mask and I was going to go, oh shit, it's Bob from accounting. Like there wasn't a mystery to it. It was just, the mystery was you never saw it. And so all you could do was imagine it. And it made the characters much more interesting. Same way that you never know Wolverine's origin. And then once you did, you're like, okay. It was much more fun when you didn't know it. You were forced to imagine it and fill in the blanks yourself. Springfield becomes very important. Snake Eyes and his origin become very important. This is where we start to sort of get into that ongoing soap opera narrative of the world that Larry Hama's building. And it sort of comes to a head in issue 10. And it's a great issue, including the very end, with an Incredible Hulk cameo and Snake Eyes and his rifle having to take a bus to Staten Island from New Jersey.
He's just one of those Times Square Hulks, though.
Right.
He's a play actor Hulk.
Well, not even Times Square. He's in Bayonne.
I know. Just
New Jersey.
Have to take that bus. Well, I mean, let's talk about the fact that the Joe's Fort Wadsworth is located on Staten Island and they're in the hidden underground bunker that goes six floors down, I think.
Yeah, more than that, probably.
They're in the motor pool there. That's who they like. And nobody at the fort who isn't part of G.I. Joe knows who they are or what they do. Everything they do is completely clandestine.
It's awesome. It's great. Except for the one issue where they said the Fort Wadsworth was in New Jersey. And then later on, I think it's in Utah. Like it's permanent.
Oh, really?
In the current books, their base is in Utah.
Oh, I thought it was in Staten Island in the beginning.
No. I'm saying in issue 303 we read last week, their base is in Utah.
And then
there's one issue in volume one where they say Fort Wadsworth is in New Jersey. It's a mistake, just like everything else in the early days was, you know, someone didn't check. But it's every other time it's Staten Island. It's not really convenient to get to places quickly. There's not like I guess they have their own airfield, but.
Better than Utah.
Well, at least you can drive out of Utah.
That's true. I feel like the cartoon takes place there in Utah because the thing's in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, for sure. So volume one is the foundation, right? You can't have the rest of the series without what they do in volume one. Volume one is not a good representation of what happens later on, but it is a fun look at it, right? It's like seeing a band super early work where they haven't quite figured it out, the music or the instruments, but they're getting there and you can hear it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I found really, really gratifying about reading it. And I read it pretty quick, even though it was one of the most two issues at a time. Every night, I've been neglecting my novel that I've been reading because at night, I'm like, oh, I can read another issue of G.I. Joe. And that's what I've been doing. So I pulled volume two right off the shelf. I don't know how far I'll go, but I had a hell of a good time on volume two. Gung Ho. Did he speak this Cajun-like on the cartoon?
He did not. Do you remember in the mid-80s that there was commercials for Ruffles?
Yeah.
And there was a guy who was like, you won't show me good like that. And like, yeah. And for a little while, Cajun speak was real popular. And I was like, yes. Oh, they're playing off that. But right. No, I did not remember. But all of his dialogue sounds like that. And I hope they stick with it through the remainder of the series.
I'm only up to issue 13. I was hoping to get further, but...
He's great.
Life got in the way.
I think I'm on 16.
It becomes this entire tapestry of characters. And again, this is written in the old 80s style of continuing soap opera, where you felt like this whole world was happening. It really did feel like an alternate world, as opposed to now where everything feels so sort of static. Mm. You really felt like you were living in the Marvel universe or G.I. Joe universe or DC. Like the way the books are written felt like that. And I think there's a little bit of that in the modern book. You know, it does feel like that. I mean, it's the same guy writing. It should feel a little bit like that. But it's obviously not written for kids anymore. They're not written to sell toys anymore. But if you think about it, 300 plus issues of G.I. Joe, that's up there with Cerebus and all those. Oh, you know, how many people have written 300 issues of a comic?
If it hadn't, I mean, I was going to say if it hadn't been part of a toy line, but then it wouldn't be what it is. You know what I mean? It sort of works for it and against it in that same way.
I don't think
way.
It diminishes it because it's almost like makes it more impressive that he was able to do this even with Hasbro looking over his shoulder.
Yeah. It was different times. Hasbro wasn't like a, you know, it was a privately owned thing. It wasn't a conglomerate. They were just like, yeah, try that.
I think it's more impressive that he's able to pull off this sort of wonderful, you said it earlier, the degree of difficulty, the threading of the needle between the tone of a kid's comic meant to sell toys and a adult comic world working out his Vietnam feelings and the whole way that comes together in a comic that really makes a lot of sense and is entertaining and it shouldn't work because they're very disparate elements. And yeah. It's amazing.
And it is not a thing that, you know, you go back to a lot of things that you liked when you were a kid and you, ooh, it's not good. You know, like I'm not watching, I'm going to make somebody mad, but like I'm guessing that I'm not going to watch a random episode of Thundercats and be like, man, this is better than I remembered.
Right.
You know, but this does that thing. As far as I am concerned.
I mean, I'm almost positive I would not enjoy looking back at He-Man. Almost positive. Yeah. But over the pandemic, when there were no comics coming out, we were doing the show, we were reviewing G.I. Joe shows. Those were super fun to watch. And this book was incredibly fun to read. For whatever that magic holds, and I understand this won't be for everybody. And if you weren't necessarily alive at the time, and you didn't have to be reading them, but if you weren't alive at that time and going through the end of the Cold War and everyone coming home with Vietnam trauma, it may not be as impactful, but it's still very good and very fun. And at the end of the day, they're not that different than superheroes. They all wear outfits. They all have code names. They all have special abilities.
But they also have that military jargon and sense of humor, you know, that is really entertaining in a lot of in a lot of stuff. And not everybody can do that, but it's here. There's an attitude. There's a frame of mind for military folks, and I do not know how to describe it. I know I do not have it, but it's present here, and it can be. It's very entertaining, and it sets you up for what kind of story you're in, even though it is dumbed down's not the word, but aged down.
Right. It was fun. I'm really glad we did this.
Yeah.
There's a crazy part of me that's like, we should do all 10 volumes, but we're not going to do that.
No, we're not.
We tried that with Starman. Didn't make it. Didn't finish the series.
Let's go back. We'll do volume 3.
Again, these are not necessarily easy to find right now. I'm hoping that it would be great if Image put them all back into print. I don't know if they will or not, but if they do, I would recommend checking them out, especially if you like, you know, comics history. Again, the first 10 issues are not really representative of the rest of the series. However, there are important things in there for the foundation of it. And man, I'm looking forward to reading more. I really am.
I want to see how far I can get. I really do.
I want to get to at least through the Snake Eyes origin stuff. Mm-hmm. It's been a long time since I read those issues. Even though I can see so many of the panels and pages in my head very clear. I haven't actually sat down and read them in so long. That cover, this files and the photographs all laid out, like that is seared into my brain. And the other one where they're fighting on the elevated subway, Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow. I still remember as a kid when they revealed that they had the same tattoo. All of us at school were like completely mind blown of what that could mean in the silent issue.
Have you ever thought about getting that tattoo in your life?
Well, of course I did.
That's what I'm saying. Like, yes. That's
of course I did. The other thing people who were not alive at the time don't understand is how much we all love ninjas. Everything was about ninjas.
Yeah, I was about to say before, like, you really can't understand what the Cold War felt like if you were in it, because it might sound like it's exaggerating, but, like, thermonuclear destruction was something that was in the back of our minds pretty much all the time.
Right. And ninjas.
So we're ninjas, right? Like, it's... They held about the same sort of space...
There was tons of movies about ninjas. We all had ninja toys. You could buy ninja costumes. Like, it was all about ninjas in the 80s. And so at this point, the book hasn't turned into a full-on ninja book, which eventually does happen.
Larry Hama's into martial arts.
We were too. We didn't know anything about it, but...
This is a nerd putting his nerd shit in there and his war trauma.
And it worked.
Yeah.
And he said gainful employment ever since. So I hope this made sense. This was a lot of all over the place, but that's kind of what G.I. Joe is. And a book like this that's so important to us, it's so, we just so many things we want to talk about, make sure we get to. This may not have been as coherent as we wanted it to be, but I enjoyed it.
If you didn't care, you're not listening at this point anyway, but if you did, it probably did make sense. So it's fine.
So the latest, as Josh mentioned, there's comics coming out now. We just talked about two of them last week. There's the G.I. Joe All-American Hero book, which is a continuation of this continuity and this story. It's issue 303 of the most recent one. There's the new Energon universe that Robert Kirkman overseeing when Skybound got the license. So there's Void Rivals, and there's Duke, and there's Cobra Commander, and there's Transformers. Those books are all in the same shared universe, but there's Duke and there's Cobra Commander. So right now there's three full-on G.I. Joe books being published, which is not unusual. In the early 2000s, we had G.I. Joe Origins, we had G.I. Joe Cobra, we had G.I. Joe Real American Hero. So it's not like this is a new thing, but right now we're back in it. We're all about it. We're in danger of turning this show entirely over to G.I. Joe, much to the horror of some of the listeners.
It'll pass.
It'll pass.
We're in a phase. It happened. I'm not sure how, but it did.
You got to let it burn out. Those of you who don't like listening to us talk about G.I. Joe, you just got to let it happen. Let it burn out, and it'll burn out, and then we'll move on to something else.
Here's the thing. You got to think of it like, for Con and I, it's like a joy combustion chamber. Like, it refills the tanks of joy, and then that spreads outwardly. Has to happen.
So if you want to hear us talk about the new books, you can listen to the Pick of the Week show, where Josh and I and sometimes special guests talk about the week's new comics. That's over at ifanboy.com, as well as Josh's Talksplode interview show, where he interviews creators. It's our sister show to this one. We alternate months, so next month will be a Talksplode. The month after that will be another Booksplode. We also have our monthly Media Splode show. All those Splode shows were unlocked by the patrons at patreon.com/ifanboy. And you can also email us in at contact@ifanboy.com if you want to get your emails in on the show, or just want to send us some feedback. You can always do it there. And follow us at ifanboycomics on Instagram. That's where you can find pretty much our only online presence is there at the moment. So we don't know what the next Booksplode is going to be. We'll figure that out. We don't know what the next Talksplode is going to be. We'll figure that out. But as soon as we know, we'll let you know.
And knowing is half the battle.
Good job. Good job.
It's like, there's something there. Hang on. I'm Josh.
I'm Connor. Bye-bye.
G.I. Joe is the code name for America's daring, highly trained special mission force. Its purpose, to defend human freedom against Cobra, a ruthless terrorist organization determined to rule the world.
He never gives up. He'll stay till the fight's won. G.I. Joe will dare.
G.I. Joe.
Hey, watch this. You're gonna pull that alarm? Why not? It'll be fun.
That kind of fun can cost a life.
Barbecue!
False alarms are no joke. They keep firefighters away from the real action. And in this business, a few seconds can mean the difference between life and death. Remember, a firefighter's job is to fight fires.
Not answer false alarms. Now I know.
And knowing is half the battle.
G.I. Joe!
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like, they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which, again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people, and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened, because I think everybody's overburdened. But it can be tough to deal with. And also, one of the things is, like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right, so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.